portion begins, Vayechi Yaakov Eretz Mitzrayim, Yaakov lived. There's only two portions in the Torah that start with the words live, and both of them deal with people that died, right? Chayesara and Vayechi Yaakov, both of them talk about that. And the main issue of the parsha is Yaakov's death scene. And before he dies, the Torah tells us as follows. At the beginning of chapter 49, Vayikra Yaakov el Bano, Yaakov called his children, Vayomer, he said to them, Hey Asvu, gather together, Vaagida Lachem, I'm going to tell you, Eis Asher Yikra Eschem, that which will happen to you, Vaacharis Hayamim, at the end of days. So now, if you follow the rest of the portion, the one thing which seems to be missing is what Yaakov just now said he was going to do. He said, come, gather together. I'm going to tell you what's going to happen at the end of days. So what would you expect to happen next? For Yaakov to tell us what's going to happen at the end of days. And that's not here. Instead, he goes off and either blessings or curses. You can decide, read them for yourselves, decide if they're really curses or blessings. For example, when he gets to right away, he goes to his first son, Reuven. He says, Reuven, b'chori ata. Reuven, you're my firstborn son. Kochi Vereshis Oni, you're my strength, you're the beginning of my vitality. Yeser Sa'es V'yeser Oz, you should have, go further and have more strength. But the next verse he says, Pachaz Kamayim, you're unstable as water. Altosar, you're not going to be able to rule. Ki Alisa Amishkabe Avicha, when you climbed on your father's couch or bed, Az Chilalta Yitzui Allah. And therefore you defiled the children that will come from you. Which means the first blessing didn't work out as a blessing. What Yaakov says is, Reuven, you blew it. The next two, Shimon and Levi, he says, you guys are violent. You guys cannot stay together. Which means you could say that he's giving them advice, he's giving them great advice. You want to say, even constructive criticism is a blessing. Can we appreciate that or no?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Of course. I mean, constructive criticism is great when you give it to someone else. When somebody gives you constructive criticism, it's not the easiest thing. In fact, it's one of the most important things that we can do. Is really, it says you should be an ohev hatochacha. You should love someone who rebukes you. I mean, all the people that tell you you're great and you're smart and you're this and you're that, so that's good. The person who's willing to tell you, the person who's, again, if they do it out of anger and out of jealousy or out of, cynicism and something else, but if somebody comes over with real sincerity, and the truth is, what I just now said is wrong, because the truth is that if anybody attacks you, you should love them for the attack, if what they're saying is true. The fact is, they may not like you, they may be jealous, they may be critical or overly critical, but if somebody takes the time to point out a flaw that you have, that's incredibly valuable. Which means if Reuven would somehow be able to take this thing, which criticism that Yaakov's saying to him, and turn it around and utilize it, that would be wonderful. I mean, Shimon and Levi, when they teamed up together, they wiped out a city. Mm-hmm. Right? And Yaakov makes an allusion to it. Shimon and Levi achim kalechem as mechoraseim. They're tools or tools of violence. V'sodom al tavo nafshi, v'kolom al tichad kvodi. He goes, I don't want to be involved with them. I'm not translating literally. Ki ba'apam hergu ish. Because in their anger, they killed people. But he says something interesting. Arur apam ki az, may their anger be cursed. Ve'evrasam ki kashasa, achalkein bi'akov afitzein bi'israel. They should be divided. It's very interesting. Once they get divided, they go in two radically different directions. So again, I can say that all of these things are blessings. If you want, you can call them curses. Call them whatever you want. What aren't they? What's missing? You already lost me. It's good. It normally takes another 3-4 minutes.
What to do in the future? Or?
Yeah, the whole thing about the future. I'm going to tell you what's going to happen at the end of days. Where's the end of days? You guys know business?
Mm-hmm.
You know what a bait and switch is?
Yeah.
Okay. This is a bait and switch. What's a bait and switch? I tell you, I'm going to advertise one product. You walk in the store, the product's not there. Yaakov advertises, I'm giving my last speech. My last speech is, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen at the end of days. Everybody comes in for the speech, what happens? It's not there. So what happened? That's the problem here. I can go and analyze all the blessings. That's great. But what about the major issue? Yaakov said he's going to tell people what's going to happen at the end of days, and he doesn't. So Rashi, based upon the rabbinic sources, tells us something frightening. He tells us that Yaakov saw a vision. He saw what was going to happen at the end of days. Mm-hmm. And what does he do? He tells them, all come, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. And then what happens afterwards? God pulls the plug. Reception goes. You can play with the antenna. Remember they used to have antennas? You can play with the antenna. You can try to plug in the cable. You can try to do whatever you want to do. Reception is gone. And Yaakov, it's true, gathered them in because he wanted to tell them what's going to happen at the end of days. It wasn't that he deliberately did what I call the bait and switch. There's nothing deliberate here. But God pulled the plug on him. Now the rabbis in the Talmud tell us that Yaakov was incredibly frightened. And I want to explain this a little bit more. But first, let me ask you a question. You know the old adage, it's better to have loved and lost than never to have loved? Have you ever heard that?
Right. Sure.
Do you agree? You don't agree? This is right? This is wrong? Yes? Yes, of course. This is easy. Okay. You'll take it out outside afterwards. How about this? Is it better to have been a prophet and lose your prophecy or never to have been a prophet?
For the person that was a prophet.
For that person.
Never.
Is that an easy question or that's a harder question?
It's a tough one. It's a hard question.
Okay, give me an answer. Huh?
For me, I'd say I'd rather not have been.
Why?
Because to find out, have that connection, have it taken away, you feel lacking.
Correct. The advantage of being a prophet is now that you know this is 100% true. There's no questions. There's no doubt. This is true. So what's the downside? If it gets taken away, at least you know it's true. What's the problem? That now you know that it's true, and now you know there's a God who created and sustains the universe, and that God does not want to talk to you anymore. That's one thing, you know, better to have loved and lost. If your girlfriend doesn't want to talk to you anymore, and every time you call, she hangs up the phone, she screens your calls, or she tells you she's busy, call in 6 years. So that itself could be somewhat traumatic. Or the ladies, if the gentleman doesn't want to call back. But what if God just doesn't want to talk to you anymore? I mean, you can develop a complex. That could be somewhat depressing. Which means, having been a prophet, having this connection, as you pointed out, and then having that connection pulled, that could be something which is overwhelming. That could be something which could destroy you. So Yaakov gathers his children, according to the Talmud, it's a passage of the Talmud. It says he looks at all of them, and they're all standing around his bed. His 12 sons are all around his bed. And he looks at them and he says, maybe there's somebody here who's inside, his inner belief system is not the same as his outside. I'll say it the other way around. His outside is not the same as his inside, which means on his outside he looks like a nice religious Jew. Of course, they were all wearing their black hats and their tzitzis out and whatever else. But he says, but maybe inside you have some kind of quarrel with God. Maybe inside you don't accept God. Maybe inside, you know what it really is? It's an inverse Murano. Right? Muranos were Jews on the inside and Spaniards on the outside. This is an inverse of this. That on the inside, on the outside, they look like great Jews, but on the inside, nothing's there. Which means, according to the Talmud, Yaakov analyzes the situation and thinks that maybe he has failed. Maybe he's failed in one of the most significant or important tasks he has in life. And what's that?
Raising
his children. Maybe his children aren't who he thinks it is. And what's the problem? It's too late right now. It's too late to do anything about it. And according to the Talmud, Yaakov's children standing around him, together in unison, say the following words. They say, Shema Yisrael. Listen, Israel. Israel is Yaakov's title. His name is Yaakov. His title is Yisrael. They say, Shema Yisrael. Listen, Israel. Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. The Lord is God. The Lord is one. And all of them accept God in unity right there in front of Yaakov. And Yaakov responds and he says, Baruch Shem Kavod Malchus Olam Vayed. Blessed is the glorious name of God forever and ever. That's what the Talmud says. And the truth is, you don't understand the passage. Truth is, we're not exactly clear why they say Shema, we're not clear why he responds the way that he does. And we're not clear why this would be a response to what's going on. So I want to explain this on a fairly deep level. But in order to get there, I need to do first a little bit of an introduction. Why would Yaakov think that all 12 of his kids are going to work out okay? You know what? It's not so easy raising children. A person needs a lot of prayer, a lot of work, a lot of luck, sight to Dishmaya. But more than that, did Yaakov's father have all of his kids were toed the line?
No.
Did his grandfather all of his kids toe the line?
No.
Which means, why would Yaakov think that his kids would when the others didn't? Which means, if Yaakov's having a death scene moment, because he thinks that the way he's understood the world till this point has may have been wrong, we need to understand how he saw the world, which really leads me back to a more basic question. And that is, why were there three forefathers? Why are there three avos? Why is it Avim, Yitzchak, and Yaakov? Why couldn't it just be one? Why could it be two? Why three? And why not four? Why not seven? Which means, why is it that in Judaism we have three forefathers?
Because of the three traits.
Good. So the three traits is great, but why not seven traits? Why not ten traits? Which means you're right. You're absolutely right. But the question is why? So let me try to explain. Judaism begins with a burst of chesed. Right? That's what Avraham is. Avraham is chesed. How would you translate chesed?
Kindness.
Olam chesed yibaneh. The world is created with chesed. Avraham's beginning, Avraham's revelation, Avraham's rebellion against the Dark Ages is that he teaches there's a world of chesed. There's a world where we need nothing. There's a world... This is not easy. It's difficult. There's a world that God needs nothing from us, and God created the world because God is absolutely altruistic. God created the world even though he needs nothing. Avraham emulates God, and Avraham becomes a man of chesed. Now, is chesed a good thing?
Yes.
You know, this sounds like a trick question, right? Is chesed a good thing?
Yes.
Sounds like a good thing. But does even something like chesed have a downside to it?
Yes.
Yes.
What's the downside to chesed?
People take advantage of it.
People can take advantage of it. What else?
You're being blind to extensive chesed.
Extensive chesed. Which means even chesed needs boundaries. Even chesed needs limitations. There's a remarkable verse in the book of Leviticus of Vayikra where it talks about incest between a brother and a sister and says that this is prohibited, and then you know what it calls it? It said chesed hu. This is chesed. How is that chesed? Which means it's very good if you love your sister or your brother. Very bad if that love manifests itself in a way which it shouldn't. Which means love, even love, needs boundaries. Even the most wonderful thing in the world, chesed, needs boundaries. And in Kabbalistic literature, there is a thing which is a manifestation of God, which is identified by Abraham, which is called chesed. But in almost all Kabbalistic ideas, there's a counterfeit to that idea. The counterfeit in Kabbalistic literature is called a klipa, which means, a klipa means a shell. You can have an orange, right? A beautiful orange, a delicious orange, full of vitamin C. Eat oranges this time of year. That's why God gives them this time of year. If you peel the orange really carefully, you can take the whole peel off, and someone looking at it can think that's the orange. But what's the orange? The orange is what's inside. What's the whole peel outside? What if you take a bite of that? It's bitter, which means the fruit is inside, the peel is on the outside, the klipa looks like the fruit, but it's superficial. We learn, Maharal probably developed this more than anyone, that the klipa, the counterfeit for Avraham, is Yishmael. According to the Midrashim, the way that Yishmael was a counterfeit for Avraham was by virtue of misusing chesed. He used chesed as a pickup line. He would go to women and say, didn't my father Avram teach you need to be kind to people? I need a little kindness right around now. Guys, don't try this. But he misused chesed. He misused chesed and tried to tell all the women around, you guys should be balei chesed. I need some chesed in my life right around now. Which means when you have this outer form of chesed without the essence of chesed, something can go wrong. Which means the world needed chesed. And I'll go back and I'll say why. God creates the world because of chesed. God's essence is one of chesed. But even that needs limitations. So chesed by itself can't exist. And if you like Hegelian dialectics, you have a very good one right over here. The thesis, therefore, would be chesed, but it requires an antithesis, one that can check the chesed and keep it in its proper limitation. And that antithesis is what's called gvur. Gvur means strength. Strength in Judaism is what? What's real strength in Judaism? Real strength is?
Determined to do Hashem's will.
Real strength, that's good. But real strength in Judaism? Eizuhu gibor hakov eshes yitzro. What's real strength? Self-limitation. Real strength in Judaism, it's very interesting. If you look at the annals of world history and they want to describe strong people, they'll always give you examples of conquerors. The more people you can conquer, the stronger you are and the better you are. The more songs that are written about you, the more books written about you, the more movies they make about you. But in Judaism, who's considered to be the hero? The person who can practice self-control. If you can control yourself, then you're stronger than the person who can control the whole army. Self-control is what's valued. And again, I don't know if you really can think this through right now, but the greatest example of self-control, Kabbalistically, is the act that God did in order to create. Because you have an infinite God, and that's all that there is an infinite God. Before creation, that all that there is infinity. And God then practices self-control, holds back infinity, and allows there to be a finite world which will now coexist with God. Which means the motivation for creation is God's chesed. But the way that the world is created is by God doing what's called gvura, and God holding back on infinity and allowing coexistence. How many of us are willing to hold back on us and ourselves and allow other people to exist? Allow other people to strive. So therefore, the very act of creation really manifests both this Avram aspect and this Yitzchak aspect, which, as I told you, is a thesis and an antithesis. So what's now going to be required afterwards?
Solution.
Synthesis. See how many of you actually know what a Hegelian dialectic is? What does it require? Say it.
Synthesis.
A synthesis. Although I'm not positive that it's a synthesis in this case. It could be a symbiosis. And it's very significant, the distinction here, but Hegel called it a synthesis, so we'll be happy with him, but I'm not sure that's what Yaakov is. Quite the opposite. I think Yaakov really is a symbiosis. And I wrote something about it. You read that or you didn't read that? You should read that, yeah.
So Hashem holding, controlling himself, controlling his selflessness, because
right.
He wants to give everything.
Right.
But for us, it's controlling selfishness,
right?
So it's a little, there is a connection, but maybe
of course there's a connection. But don't you get it? We're in the image of God. The image of God means we're a mirror image. We're the inverse of God. God is infinite. We're finite. An infinite being controls the infinity. We're finite. We control something which is finite, and it's a complete opposite. I mean, there's a very deep point about this. That's why when God creates the world, right? Shabbos is a memory for creation. So what did God do when He created? He held back infinity. What do we do on Shabbos? We hold back our work. And what we're doing then is we're being just like God. But it's because we're in the mirror image. Hope somebody followed that.
Mm-hmm.
So now you realize why there was a requirement for there to be Avraham, one. Chesed is great. But now you need there to be an antithesis. You need there to be a stop on chesed, holding back. Yitzchak is gvura, Yitzchak is strength, Yitzchak is self-control. What's the counterfeit of Yitzchak? What's the counterfeit of Gvura? Esav. Why? Because Esav just takes the outside of the strength. He takes the strength in its superficial level. He looks again at that peel of it just on the outside, and he says, oh, my father's into Gvura, so now for he sees his strength as dominating others. So just like you can have a great thing called Chesed by Avraham and have a counterfeit, you can have a great thing represented by Yitzchak, which is Gvura, and have a counterfeit. So then you take the positive of Mitch, the positive of Avraham, the positive of Yitzchak, you pull it together, and now you have something which is called in capitalistic terminology
Teferis.
And what's Teferis mean?
Beauty.
Because what makes it beautiful? Because it gathered. It is that action of taking the good of both and putting them together, and now you have beauty. Now, this is Yaakov's understanding of the world. Yaakov understood what his grandfather was. Yaakov understood what his father was. Yaakov understood who his uncle was, and Yaakov understood who his brother is. By the way, one of the scariest verses in the Torah is we're told that Esav goes and gets married to Yishmael's daughter. So here you have this merger between the two klipos. You have a merger between these two counterfeits coming together. That's very strange. That's very frightening. Because the merger of Islam and Christianity, who both want to kill Yaakov, is a very frightening thing. But enough about that right now. That's just, if you really think about it, you won't sleep at night. So Yaakov's understanding of the world is everything's done. Spiritually, everything's done. Once everything came together, once Teferis now comes into the world, and you have this merger of the good of Avram, the good of Yitzchak, and they're there, so now he can have all of the tribes. There needs to be no more foundation. Now you can have the 12 tribes. So everything is good till we get to his death scene. What happens then? God pulls the plug. When God pulls the plug, what does Yaakov think? He thinks that he failed. He thinks that that just didn't work. By the way, is there a counterfeit to Teferis? The counterfeit to Teferis should be, so far we have murder and sexual sin. So what's the third one you'd be looking for?
Idolatry.
The counterfeit of Teferis is idolatry. Why? Because if you see beauty in everything, you'll also see beauty in the sun and the moon and the rocks and the stars and everything else that you see around you. And then the line between monotheism and pantheism will get very, very thin. Because once you have this all-inclusive view, and everything is beautiful, so that everything in nature is beautiful as well. And why can't, if God made this chair, why can't I worship the chair? God made a rock, why can't I worship the rock? God made the sun, why can't I worship the sun? And that's the first step towards idolatry, is to start looking at the things that God created and seeing them in terms of their own value and dependency. Now the truth is that Yaakov's klipa, Yaakov's counterfeit, is not within the people. It's in this all-inclusive ideology, which actually is what Moshe did when he left Egypt. How did it manifest itself? Not yet. One more step. How did it manifest itself? By doing too inclusive in terms of who leaves Egypt. So who does he include? He also includes the Erev Rav. He also includes others who are not part of the Jewish people, which means the all-inclusive philosophy of Teferis, the all-inclusive philosophy of taking everything in, will lead to idolatry, but by way of the Erev Rav. So that's the counterfeit of Yaakov, which means the truth is that once you have Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, now Am Yisrael, the Jewish people, will emerge from this, and everything is in line, but it doesn't mean that we're ever safe. There's always going to be these threats, sometimes represented by Esav, sometimes by Yishmael, sometimes when they come together, sometimes by the Erev Rav, by the pretenders. There are threats out there, and these are the three cardinal sins. And by the way, at the golden calf, they were guilty of idolatry, of murder, and of sexual sins. It all got rolled up together in one glorious rebellion. But that's not for today. Was there ever an earlier point in Yaakov's life that he lost his prophecy? And I want you to pay attention right now. If we track Yaakov's life, when was the first time we find God speaking to him?
Jacob's
life. Or the ladder. when he's leaving Israel, God speaks to him. Mm-hmm. When's the next time that God speaks to him? When he tells him to come back. When's the next time that God speaks to him? No, there's a time before that. God tells him to go to Beit El. God tells him to build the altar finally. And after the story of Dinah, we have God saying, go to Beit El. And after that, we have silence. The next time God speaks to Yaakov is when he's on the way down to Egypt. Which means, if you've ever been wondering about this, If Yaakov is a prophet, this is a very bad question, but it bothers a lot of people anyway. If Yaakov's a prophet, then why doesn't he know where Yosef is? You know why it's a bad question? It's a bad question because just because you're a prophet doesn't mean you know everything. To be a prophet doesn't mean you have all knowledge. You have the knowledge that God allows you to have. So that's why it's a bad question. But now I'll give you a better answer. Because God didn't speak to him the whole time that Yosef isn't there. Take a look in the text. The whole time Yosef isn't there, God doesn't speak to him once. The rap.
But there isn't, the focus in the Torah while Yosef is gone isn't on Yaakov.
Correct.
It's on Yosef.
Right. And I'll say it again. I can't interpret what's not there. Even though I will. But what did I say before? When does God speak to Yaakov? So I can show you every time in Torah that he speaks. I can also point that there's a very significant 22-year silence that God doesn't speak to him. Okay, that's 22 years? 29.
Was he speaking to him when he was working under the fruit of the vine?
It's not clear. At the very end there, he gets a dream. But during the whole time that Yosef is away, we don't find one time that God speaks to him. And when he's told that Yosef is alive, what does the Torah then say? Vatichi ruach. The spirit of Yaakov came back. Now that's very interesting. What should have it said? And Yaakov was happy. V'samach Yaakov. What should it say? It should say Yaakov was overjoyed. But how does the Torah phrase it when he finds out his son is alive? His spirit comes back to life. Vatichi ruach Yaakov. So what do you think the rabbis, you can all make believe you're rabbis today. What do you think the rabbis conclude from that verse when it says that Yaakov's spirit came back? It means his prophecy came back. His Ruach HaKodesh. The whole time that Yosef was away, he had no Ruach HaKodesh. Tichi Ruach Yaakov Avihim. That's in chapter 45, verse 27. Mem Yaakov's spirit comes back. So the rabbis tell us, therefore, the whole time Yosef was away, he didn't have prophecy. Now, one of the reasons he wouldn't have prophecy is that one of the things which are necessary to have prophecy is joy and happiness. If you're not happy, you can't have prophecy. You need there to be joy in your life to prophecy. Because you know what depression is? Depression is being self-centered. I don't want to pick on people who are depressed, but depression is very limiting. Depression is not only limiting, depression means that you're stuck in the present tense. And anybody who's depressed, if they were able to anticipate that tomorrow would be a good day, would already feel better. But when you're depressed, you can't feel that tomorrow. Healthy people have a bad day. What do they say?
Tomorrow's
I'm going to bed, which is depression. I'm going to bed. I had enough already. Right? And but again, a healthy person doesn't ignore when something's bad. But what do you say to yourself? Tomorrow, I'm going to have more strength, and tomorrow's going to be good, and tomorrow, I'm going to make it better. That's what a healthy person does. Somebody who's depressed can't see that tomorrow. Tomorrow's going to be the same as today, which means... You know, you think about God who transcends time, space, and matter, and for God the past, present, and the future is all the same, and we live within time, but part of being a real Jew is to be able to somehow to transcend God, transcend time and to be like God, which is a lot of what the whole story of Passover is about. But the person who's depressed, he allows the past to impact the present and to destroy the future. And what we need to do, because we do live within a past, present, and future, is to be able to understand that which happened yesterday is yesterday, today is today, and tomorrow is going to be tomorrow, and it's my job to make that tomorrow a great tomorrow. Mm-hmm. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
I don't want to put all psychologists, psychiatrists out of business, but we can. Again, if you could just focus on that one point, that's it. They're all out of business. Because what are they going to do? They're going to go back to the past again. Well, so how exactly did they abuse you? And how exactly did they do this? And they're going to take you right back to the past again. And they'll try to relive it, and we'll get to that moment of... I'm not making too much fun, am I?
Right.
My father's a psychologist. He put me through college to be a psychologist. Actually, I shouldn't make fun of it. My brother is, and my sister is. But my father's also a rabbi, so he didn't take it all that seriously. just a job. Part of... part of the reason the prophecy can't work is, as you said, because you're stuck in yourself. You're stuck in that own problem. You really realize that God controls the universe. By the way, right then, shouldn't you be depressed? God controls the universe. Should I be depressed?
No.
No.
God controls the universe, so that thing which happened to me is God is speaking to me. So let me try to work that out a little bit. Let me try to do... God is speaking to me. God is telling me something. Wow, that's a gift. How can I use that gift for tomorrow? So I'm just saying, depression is really I get stuck in myself. I have to break those boundaries, and I have to try to break through and get to this point of joy. I get to joy. Now I can be a vessel that I can take God's prophecy. Yaakov was very sad when he thought Yosef was dead. And it says he was inconsolable?
Inconsolable?
He couldn't be consoled. Which means that Yosef is going on, Yaakov, year after year after year, stuck with the death of Yosef, or the perceived death of Yosef. And then after all of this time, something happens. He finds out that Yosef is indeed alive. And when he finds out that Yosef is alive, so now what happens? Now the melancholy disappears. The depression disappears. The sadness disappears. The realization that God had a plan, because not only is Yosef alive, Yosef is in control of all of Egypt. So now he realizes that something completely different is going on. So at this point, the past, the present, and the future become something very different than being stuck in his present tense influenced by the past. And at this point, Yaakov's spirit comes back. But the rabbis tell us it's worse than that. The whole time he thought Yosef was dead, he thought he had failed as a father. He thought he had failed as a Jew. This dream of Avram and Yitzhak and Yaakov somehow creating the Jewish people, he thought that that didn't happen. That he dropped the baton, as they say. Avram took it and handed it to Yitzhak. Yitzhak took it and handed it to Yaakov. And Yaakov drops it. And that's it. The rabbis tell us that Yaakov was convinced during the whole time that Yosef was gone. The whole time that Yosef was gone, he was convinced that he was going to hell. That he had failed. Which means the loss of prophecy in all those years was devastating. And then the Torah tells us something fascinating. That Yaakov meets up with Yosef. He comes... They see each other. I want to get to the exact verse. This is in chapter 46, Perek Memvos, Pasuk Tes. But yes, Sir Yosef Markovaso, but Yalakros Yitzchak Aviv Goshna. He goes and travels to Goshen to see his father. But Ye Ra'elav, he sees him. But Ye Pol Al Tzavarav, he falls on his neck. But Yev, he cried Al Tzavarav Od on his neck longer. So it's interesting, it's all in the singular. Yosef sees his father. Yosef embraces him. Yosef cries. What was Yaakov doing? So Rashi here says that Yaakov was saying the Shema. And as my wife would say, Jewish men always find a time when you need the most to go and pray. Mm-hmm. Right? Time to help with the kids in the morning? Sorry, got to go to shul. Chakras. Time to help in the evening? Sorry, got to go to Marav. Mm-hmm. If in case she needs me in the afternoon, sorry, Mincha. If she needed me more, I'd become a Muslim, right? Chas v'shalom. Why at this moment, any screenwriter could have done a better job over here. Why at this moment, after all these years, when they see each other and they embrace, why is Yaakov saying Shema? So I'm going to say this on two levels. One level is that what does it say in Shema? Love God with all your heart and all your soul. Maybe at that moment, Yaakov felt so much love towards his son. So much love towards his son that was overwhelming. And you can understand it. But Yaakov's a spiritual giant. And if he feels so much love towards his son at this moment, he wants to take that love and focus it towards God as well. So that moment that his son is holding on to after all those years, what does he say? He merges together this experience of being a father, together with thanking God and saying, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Now, the truth is that answer, I like it, but it really focuses on the next line of Shema. V'hafta t'Hashem Elokecha, love God with all your heart and all your soul. So therefore, he wants to show that he loves God with all his soul. But why does it say he's saying the Shema? So it's a good answer. It's a drop clumsy, because it should have said he was saying v'hafta t'Hashem Elokecha. So you could say it means the same thing. So I want to give you another answer. And this will go back and bring us back to the beginning. When we say Shema, and hopefully we say it at least two times, maybe three times a day, when we say Shema, we do something which is strange compared to all the other prayers that we do. What's that strange thing that we do?
We cover our eyes.
We cover our eyes. And again, there's two reasons for it. One reason would be in order to be able to concentrate, to block out the whole world, not to see anything else, to put blinders on, and to say Shema. Is that a good answer? It's a good answer, but not good enough. Why? There's lots of parts of davening that we should want to focus on. Why only this part? What's the other reason that we cover our eyes when we say Shema? Is that the Shema is so holy, the Shema is so intense, that if you say Shema properly, the Shekhinah, God's glory, comes into the room at that moment. And God's glory is so strong that it can make you blind. And when we say the Shema, we want to say it in such a way that we really believe about the intensity of it. And as we're going to say it, we're going to say, I believe now that I'm going to say this word, I'm going to say these words, and God's presence comes to the room, that's going to be so scary, I better cover my eyes because God's presence is going to be in the room. The problem with all prayer is that we just do it by rote. You do it by rote, so you do it every single day, a couple times a day, okay, and you move on. But say it like you believe it. Cover your eyes because God's presence is going to be there. And by the way, if God's presence comes into the room when you say Shema, if that really works, I don't know if any of you remember this. Pick on you. In the Beis HaMikdash, during the Yom Kippur service, the Kohanim, specifically the Kohen Gadol, it's the Kohanim as well, Kohen Gadol will say God's name a number of times. Every time they would say God's name in the Beis HaMikdash, they would say God's real name. Every time they would say God's name, how would the people respond to God's name in the Beis HaMikdash?
Shema.
What?
Shema.
No. Good guess. How they respond to God's name? No.
Baruch Shem.
Baruch Shem. Right? Kohanim, right? And they say, Kishiyotza Shem HaGadol, right? And the Furish, Viti, Kohen Gadol, Kol Ha'am. What does it say? Korim, Uvishtachavim, Benoflim, Alpneim, Va'omrim, Baruch Shem Kavod, Machus Olam Bayim. The response to the name of God, which is so strong, which brings the Shekhinah into the room, the response of man is to say, what? Blessed is the name of God. Why? Because you just saw it. The name of God came into the room. If God came into the room, the Shekhinah, God's glory, came into the room. So how are you going to respond? You're going to say, blessed, Baruch Shem Kavod Machus Olam Vayed. Blessed is the name, Baruch Shem. Blessed is the name, the glorious name, the kingly glorious name of God forever and ever. Why are you going to say that? Because it just happened. So the response to the response to God's name being said, the response to the Shekhinah coming back, is saying the Shema and saying Baruch Shem Kavod Malchus Olam Vayed. Yaakov, when he sees Yosef, now has so much joy in his life. At this point, Yaakov's prophecy now became completely clear. When he's holding on to Yosef, he's saying the Shema, because now he's one with God's glory. God's essence now is right there with him. When Yaakov loses his ability to prophesize, what do all of his sons do? They all say the Shema together. Because what do they want to try to do? They want to try to bring God back into the room. And it works. How do I know that it works? Because Yaakov responds and he says, Baruch Shem Kavod Malchus Olam Vayed. But what's the problem?
What does he say?
What?
What does he say? What happens then?
The problem is that even though that he felt God's presence in the room, it says, Vayishtach Yisrael Rosh Hamita, says, we bow down to the head of the bed. Why? It says, because he felt God there at the head of the bed. He felt God in the room. But what happened? God showed him what was going to happen at the end of days, but God withheld it from him. Not every single prophecy is shared with every single person. And again, it's frustrating. But God let him see it, but he didn't want him to share it. Why? Can you imagine what would have been if Yaakov would have said to his kids, listen, 4,000 years from now, it's going to be great. Can you imagine how depressing that would be to know that we had 4,000 years before things work out properly? Do you realize the incredible chesed that God performed by not letting him inform us what was going on? But I want to go a step deeper into what the Shema is. When Yaakov's children said Shema, they said the words, Shema Yisrael, hear, O Israel, Hashem Elokeinu. What is Hashem? Yud-Kei Vav-Kei. What does that mean? God as representing Chesed, right, which is important. Hashem Elokeinu. What's Elokeinu? God representing Din. God representing judgment. Which means it's really Avraham's aspect and Yitzchak's aspect. Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Achad, God is one. Which means that the realities is a merger together. So now you realize that the saying of the Shema is in and of itself a merger of those two sides of the Chesed and the Din coming together. So that Yaakov would have said Shema, sorry, the children of Yaakov would have said Shema Yisrael, listen Israel, who are they talking to? They're talking to their father. But why would Yaakov say Shema Yisrael? And for that matter, why do we say Shema Yisrael? Which means today, when we say Shema, what should we really say? We should say every day, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Achad. Right? The Lord is God, the Lord is one. That's all that we should say. Why do we say Shema Yisrael? So we need to understand what Yisrael means. Remember a couple minutes before I talked about depression and I talked about being stuck in the present tense? Mm-hmm. So what is Yisrael? The word Yisrael, what does it refer to? Israel refers to the entirety of the Jewish people. Good? Mm-hmm. Which entirety? It's every single Jew who's ever lived, past, present, and future. When we say the Shema, you say it with Kavanah, you say it with focus, you say it with belief. When you say the Shema, you're connecting with your great-great-great-great-grandparents who've been dead for 10 generations, and you connect with your grandchildren who haven't been born yet. The Shema allows you to connect throughout history, just to go back and forth. Because who are you speaking to? You're speaking to Yisrael. What is Yisrael? Every Jew who's ever lived. And we need to remember that there's a thing called Yisrael. Who did God give the land of Israel to? Yisrael, all of it. Which ones? Throughout history. Which means if some people today say, we want to give away this part of Israel, I'm not going to get involved in the political question, could they, should they, or would they? Maybe it's a good idea, maybe not a good idea, but it's not binding. It's not binding. The Jewish people still own the land, and it does make a difference. Because God didn't give it to any particular person. Again, caretakers are allowed to take care of things, but it's not theirs. Who's the Torah given to? Which Jewish people? Remember, what did the Midrashim say? All Jewish people were there. All the souls were there. Exactly. The Torah is given to every single generation together. If you ever go to a rabbi and say, teach me something, he says, listen, I don't want to teach you. Say, you're stealing. So why are you stealing? Because it's my inheritance. This belongs to me as much as it does to you. The Torah is given to every single Jew throughout. The problem is that we have such a large number of Jews who are not necessarily interested in their inheritance. So the first thing I have to do is remind them, you guys got a treasure which is waiting for you. The Shema has been something which Jews have said at death. Yaakov said it. His son said it to him. Rabbi Akiva says it when he's about to die. Throughout generations, people have said Shema when they're about to die. And when they say that Shema, and then you think about the Shema of Rabbi Akiva, his student, he's being tortured to death. He's being skinned alive. And it says it's time to say Shema, which, by the way, I'm not convinced it means the time of morning or evening, or the time historically to say Shema. It's time in history, because so many people could have given up and said the Second Temple was destroyed, and the Bar Kokhba rebellion was squashed, and the martyrs were killed, and Rabbi Akiva, the great Rabbi Akiva, is being killed, and maybe we should give up hope. And Rabbi Akiva gets up and says, now my whole life I waited for this moment. And Rabbi Akiva says Shema with unbelievable conviction. How much conviction did he say Shema with? That every single Jew throughout history, again, who knew, connected to Rabbi Akiva, who's been, again, if you think about 2,000 years since Rabbi Akiva, the vast majority of them have known about Rabbi Akiva. But Jews know that if you're about to be killed, what do you say? You say the Shema. Rabbi Akiva taught them that. Because Rabbi Akiva said Shema with so much conviction, people heard it 2,000 years later. In the war two years ago, there was a soldier named Roy Klein. Did you hear about Roy Klein? So we don't have enough heroes. Roy Klein is a hero. Roy Klein was an officer in the Israeli army. and a Palestinian threw a grenade at him and his soldiers. So you have a half a second to react, a quarter of a second, a tenth of a second to react. So you know what he did? Because he realized that he did the math very quickly. If he does nothing or he tries to jump from it, good chance he and all the soldiers get killed. So you know what he did? He jumped on it. He got killed, and he screamed the Shema before he got killed. Again, a quarter of a second. He loved the other soldiers, and he realized, I can't save everybody. Let me try. And he did save them, by the way. He says, I can't save myself. Let me say that, and he says the Shema. I'm sure Rabbi Akiva greeted him when he got up to heaven. I told you the end of last week. There's a war going on. The first soldier who was killed, Dvir. I knew Dvir. My sons were friends with Dvir. One of my sons got out of the army to go to the funeral. I sat with his mother yesterday. The kid was a tzaddik. No, I'm not saying that. He was a tzaddik. He was a guy who was a ben Torah. He was a religious boy. He went and he learned. During his spare time, he was an ambulance. He worked for Magen David Adom. During his other spare time, he worked with kids. During his other spare time, his father died 2 years ago of cancer. And he didn't have to join a combat unit. And he sat and he thought and he talked to people and he decided that he wanted to join a combat unit. He was in an officer's training program and he didn't have to go to the battle in Gaza. But he decided that he wanted to be with his unit. And he sent an SMS to his mother, the last thing he sent. And he says, I love you and you're the best mother there is. And he says, but the people in the south are being attacked and we have to stop it. And this was the last line that he wrote. We have to bring kavod, we have to bring glory back to the Jewish people. The Jewish people need glory. Okay? That's the last thing that he writes. I don't know if he got to say the Shema beforehand or didn't, but he said kavod for Am Yisrael, which is very close to Baruch Shem, kavod Malchus Olam Vayed. He understood that the Jewish people needed to be glory. His mother said, I told his mom, my other son who couldn't come said, I should ask what message I give. So he said in Hebrew, which is very simple, maybe too simple, so I don't know if you'll get it. He said, tell her, tagid la shehu haya achad min atovim. So what does that mean? One of the good ones. But for an Israeli kid to say, achad min atovim, that's the best he can have. One of the good ones, that's as good as it gets. The best meal you get, he says, achad min atovim, that's one of the good ones. So I told her this. I said, that's what he said, that's his message. And she said, everybody tells me this. He goes, why did he have to be so good? Why does my son have to be the one who's so good? Why did my son be the one have to volunteer? So what, good, you all train to be rabbis now, right? So what am I supposed to answer? Exactly. He said, some questions, there's no answers. And there's certainly no answers when a woman is sitting Shiva for the second time in 3 years. But realize that the guys that are down there, they are sanctifying God's name. They're there. Again, it doesn't get clearer than that. They're there to bring glory to the Jewish people. And if we're here learning, and if we're here praying, then we should pray, and we should say the Shema, and we should connect to the soldiers that are there. We should connect to our grandparents. We should connect to our grandchildren. In order to do this, we all need to say Shema with a great deal of conviction. Good choice.